Good morning. It's always good for me to be back in New San Francisco, in one of my favorite cities in the world. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be here too long, since I have to go to LA and then Mexico City. Before I begin, I would like to give my thanks to the sponsors of this event, the World Affairs Council of Northern California, the Bay Area World Trade Center, the Chilean Chamber of Commerce, Philip Fisher, and an old friend, Ambassador Pastorino, that we served together when I was in the Foreign Service in Mexico City. I will speak for about 10 to 15 minutes and no more than that, and then of course I will open the session to questions that you may have on what I have spoken or any other questions you may have to me. As many of you know, Chile is a special country in our hemisphere. There are many reasons for Chile's uncommonness, but the essence of the country's uniqueness is that Chile comprises a rapidly growing, developing economy, an exceedingly well-managed democracy with the fact the Chilean government is working just as hard as we are on just these matters. As many as you may remember, shortly after President Eduardo Frei assumed office in 1994, he traveled to Washington, D.C. on his first visit, where he met President Bill Clinton, and they agreed to establish a consultative framework. This is a domestic tranquility necessary for democracy to prosper, and is endowed with innovative entrepreneurs and courageous policy, this consultative framework is the framework which established the relationship on a formal basis between Chile and the United States. This is a high-level dialogue among the senior officials of both governments to discuss issues of mutual interest between our two countries, and a very important network through which our two governments can communicate our interests and aspirations. Pursuant to this framework, Secretary of State Juan Christopher visited Chile in February of this year and held important and productive discussions with Chile's President Frei as well as Foreign Minister José Miguel Insulza. Since both the United States and Chile are members of the UN Security Council, the Secretary and the Foreign Minister took time to reaffirm our cooperation on global issues ranging from Iraq to Cuba. For example, we have just finished a close collaboration on the issue of China at the UN Human Rights Commission meetings in Geneva. In the few areas where we differ, we listen carefully to each other and we respect each other's views, and that is the base of this very cordial and positive and mature relationship we now have with Chile. Then in March, Secretary of Defense William Perry also visited Chile and met with his counterpart to discuss security cooperation in this hemisphere and the world. This has helped us to develop the important aspect of trust in our bilateral cooperation. Underscoring that effort, the United States exhibited a wide range of our most advanced military aircraft at the FIDAI air show in Santiago during March, the biggest such event in this part of the world. We discussed regional security issues and issues of military cooperation that remain very important to both countries. In addition to receiving numerous visits from U.S. senators and congressmen, other U.S. officials interested in strengthening our commercial and political ties have come to Chile recently. Secretary of Transportation Federico Peña visited Santiago in April for a hemispheric meeting of transport ministers. While in Santiago, Secretary Peña held talks with his Chilean counterpart to promote U.S. participation in Chile's major projects in the transportation sector. The Secretary also discussed expanded air service between the United States and Chile, as later this year we will have to renew our civil aviation agreement. What does all this high-level interest show? I believe it demonstrates a recognition of Chile's accomplishments and our interest in adding to the mutual benefit they represent through trade, investment, and in many other ways. Also, by recognizing the country's achievements, Chile showcases the potential of all of Latin America and the Caribbean to achieve the same thing. Let me cite some what I think impressive data on Chile. The real growth of Chile's economy may surpass 7% this year. Chile's economy has averaged 6.5% real growth for the last 12 years. That's among the world's best country performances. And Chile's high domestic savings and investment rates, 28% of GDP, the highest in this hemisphere, should ensure sound growth of the economy into the 21st century. Second, U.S. exports to Chile rose to $3.8 billion in 1995 from $2.6 billion in 1994. Chile is expected to import over $16 billion worth of goods in 1996. Three, total foreign investment in Chile amounted to $4.3 billion in 1995. The U.S. investors continued to show great confidence in Chile. Our enterprises poured over $1.5 billion in direct investment into Chile in 1995, more than 30% increase over 1994. Inflation has moderated. It has dropped from a rate of 27% in 1990 to 8% in 1995. The rate is expected to edge up a bit further in 1996. Prudence by the independent central bank and strong flow of dollars from exports and investment have kept the Chilean peso relatively stable. The currency has averaged from 405 to 415 pesos per dollar over the last 12 months. No abrupt decline in the peso's value is expected in the foreseeable future. Now let me go to a subject that may be of interest to some of you, which is the issue of Chile's accession to NAFTA. With all this good news, that is, with all this evidence of very good management and Chile's skillful facilitation of enterprise, the United States government believes Chile would become a first-class addition to NAFTA. An exemplar of what we and our NAFTA partners are looking for in new members, countries with strong open economies, and progressive and perfectible trade and investment rules. Indeed, that is the way we and our NAFTA partners, Canada and Mexico, view Chile's application to join. From Chile's point of view, belonging to NAFTA would open new vistas of opportunity and influence both regionally and in the wider world arena. Membership would also give Chile preferential access to the North American market, the premier world market, and that of its largest trading partner, the United States, and would give Chile a leg up on other mid-sized developing countries in negotiating with other economic areas such as the European Community, APEC, and Mercosur. From North America's vantage point, Chile offers the current NAFTA countries a growing market for all manner of goods and services. consumer and capital goods as well as technology. The modernizing influence arising from membership in NAFTA could give Chile just the boost it needs to join the ranks of the developed countries early in the next century. The Chileans, hearing all the plaudits from the NAFTA partners on Chile's economic and political progress, fully assumed that Chile would join NAFTA in 1995. Thus, you can imagine the great disappointment in Santiago when it became evident late last year that the U.S. Congress and the executive branch will not be able to reach agreement on language on the so-called fast-track authority to negotiate Chile's accession into NAFTA. Chile is convinced that the fast-track mechanism is an essential element for the negotiation of critical issues of our accession into NAFTA. Without fast-track, the U.S. Congress would essentially require a renegotiation of the agreement point by point, something that, of course, Chile did not want to get into. So why has the fast-track proposal failed so far to pass in the U.S. Congress? I think it failed for four principal reasons. First, the President had asked for authority from the Congress to negotiate provisions on labor and environmental standards in the Chilean accession, but most of the Republican members in the House objected to those lateral agreements. They prefer that provisions of these matters be left out on trade negotiations. Second, NAFTA is currently out of favor with many Americans for reasons that have mostly to do with the Mexican peso crisis and the political problems that country still faces. Third, a number of representatives in this Congress question the benefits of free trade. And fourth, fast-track authority was withheld because Congress, approaching the 1996 elections, wished, I think, to deny President Clinton's administration a foreign affairs victory, which Chile's accession to NAFTA would definitely have been one of them. As a result of the lack of U.S. congressional action on fast-track, it is doubtful that this legislation will have a chance of being passed until after the November elections. Chile will wait patiently for the legislation and will aim for an early entry into NAFTA. Meanwhile, Chile is conducting its trade diplomacy actively and is pursuing opportunities with the European Union and Mercosur, the trading bloc which comprises Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And Chile is currently negotiating a free trade agreement with Canada. It already has one with Mexico, while waiting for the U.S. to decide what we will do on the issue of NAFTA and Chile. The President has said clearly that the United States remains committed to Chile's accession to NAFTA, and he has instructed the U.S. Trade Representative to explore every opportunity for progress on the matter. Now to the subject of Chile's democracy. I mentioned at the beginning of my speech that Chile is a very strong and viable democracy. It is a young democracy in the sense that democracy lapsed in Chile during the period of dictatorship between 1973 and 1990. Since 1990, Chile has been relearning the practice of democracy. So it's logical to question the stability and the robustness of Chile's democracy. One good touchstone was the imprisonment of ex-Chilean intelligence chiefs, Generales Manuel Contreras and Brigadier Pedro Espinosa, who ordered the assassination in Washington in 1978 of former Chilean ambassador to the United States, Orlando Letelier, and Robbie Moffat. The Chilean public waited patiently during this period as the Chilean judicial system proceeded with its prosecution of this case. The carrying out of justice in this case was slow, but it was sure, and it showed that in spite of opposition from many in the military to punishing Contreras and Espinosa, no one is above the rule of law in Chile. The fact that the Chilean military did not lose faith during the transition to democracy is an extremely important element in the enduring success of the transition from dictatorship to democracy. Rather than leaving office disgraced and humiliated as they have in other countries in the Americas, the Chilean military saw their leaving political office as a bowing to the will of the electorate in the plebiscite in 1988. The genius of Chilean domestic political relations and the prime reason why the transition to democracy has continued smoothly in the 6 years since democracy was reestablished is that the right and the left, military and the civilians, have avoided conflict over difficult structural issues such as the appropriateness of a guaranteed role for the Chilean military in the government. The Chilean constitution, for example, reserves 9 seats in the Chilean Senate for members designated by the president, the armed forces, the Supreme Court, and the Chilean government National Security Council. Only the remaining 38 members of the Senate are popularly elected. Both the current president of Chile and his predecessor, President Elwin, have sought to eliminate these appointed senators without success. The other item on the political agenda concerns the reconciliation of the Chilean people. Though Chile was spared with the vicious civil wars fought between the right and the left wings of other Latin American countries, it endured years of military government and leftist terrorism. Memories of this violence are vivid and continue to alienate Chileans one from another. The Chilean government has sought to put this terrible epoch behind by trying to promote revelations of the fate of those disappeared and at the same time establishing a sort of qualified amnesty for the perpetrators, in large part to induce them to come forward to share in confidence information on the fate and whereabouts of their victims. Of course, what this approach requires is ultimately a collective willingness to forgive. In November of last year, General Augusto Pinochet, who is still commander of the army and is revered by many Chileans, for the first time lamented the victims of both sides during his rule. And for their part, in private, the left often points out how few human rights violators are still at large. However, recent efforts towards a law useful to reconciliation, and both sides have shown great forbearance in avoiding demagoguery on the subject, have taken place in the full glare of heated public debate and show that more time must pass before forgiveness is possible. I mentioned earlier the special relationship our two countries enjoy, and I believe, in spite of the setback we're experiencing on Chile's accession to NAFTA, that our bilateral relations will only grow closer. Chilean Foreign Minister Insulza has made clear the Chilean government's position that this setback on NAFTA will not diminish our excellent bilateral relations. In fact, Chile and the U.S. see eye to eye on most issues. For example, as a result of our close cooperation on the Security Council at the UN, Chile's ambassador to the United Nations joined the State Department in condemnation of the Cuban government for its cowardly downing of 2 unarmed general aviation aircraft over international waters near Cuba some months ago. The essence of U.S.-Chile relations is our shared common values and aspirations, the power of democracy, human rights, and open economies, and the goals of hemispheric peace and integration. However, with special relationships flow special responsibilities. For our part, we should anticipate that Chile will continue to offer substantial support to U.S. policies, both regionally and beyond. However, we have to keep in mind that Chile is by habit always sharing to break with Latin American consensus positions on many issues, particularly on regional ones. Though Chile's supporter us to the hilt on the Cuban downing of the aircrafts, Chile, along with virtually all countries in Latin America, has been unsympathetic to the U.S. efforts to punish Cuba economically. Chile believes Cuba should indeed correct its human rights abuses, but should be allowed to grow and evolve economically in the hopes that it will evolve politically. So I close, I'd like to repeat what I said about the excellent state of U.S.-Chile relations. I also want to reiterate that Chile will pursue good economic and political alliances wherever she can find them, regionally or extra-regionally. We must keep in mind that the longer Chile remains outside of NAFTA, the more Chile will orient itself to our other trading partners. I think it's a shame for us to force Chile to look away from the United States for alternate economic opportunity. And I hope that we will be able to resume negotiations with Chile on NAFTA accession as soon as possible in 1997. Thank you for your attention, and I'm ready to take any questions you may have. Thank you very much.
A couple of people who we have here in our audience today. One is Ambassador and Consul General Alvaro Zuniga from the Chilean Consul to the United States, and also the President of our Chilean American Chamber of Commerce, Jorge Bernales. And now I'd like to take questions that you can ask Ambassador Aguirre. And I think we have a mic here, so if people want to come up to the mic, that might be helpful.
I'm James Bridgman from Haskell and Bridgman here in the city. I have two quick questions for you, Minister. First, how do Mexico and Canada feel about the entry of Chile into the NAFTA agreement? And what will be Chile's relationship to the Mercosur after entry?
Well, as I mentioned during my speech, Chile already has a trade relation agreement with Mexico, which was completed about 3 years ago. So Mexico is supportive of Chile's accession to NAFTA. But with respect to Canada, also, they don't have a trade agreement yet, but they're working on one. Right now, as we speak, the Chileans are in Ottawa, and the conversations are going very well. They have now met three times, and the idea is that they will conclude this bilateral trade agreement sometime, not in July, in September, and President Frey will then go to Ottawa sometime this year, where then they will sign. So, and Canada, I have to say, has been a major booster of Chile's accession to NAFTA. They have been very supportive. And I think this bilateral trade agreement that they're working on now will be successfully concluded, and since it's done within the confines of the NAFTA trade agreement, it will also help to accelerate the four-country discussions, hopefully next year when they sit down to discuss Chile's accession to NAFTA. Mercosur, I think that since NAFTA did not occur last year, it behooved President Frey to seek a hit, a good one. And I think that pushed the Mercosur countries, especially Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, to politically move and remove the obstacles that existed between them, which were at the negotiating table with the with the negotiators, and I think that they have successfully done that. And everything indicates that by June 25th of this year, they will sign this special relationship between Chile and Mercosur. Chile will not join Mercosur. It will not be part of Mercosur, but it will have a special relationship with Mercosur.
Good morning. My name is Jaime Mock, and I just wanted to do a follow-up on the Mercosur question. I understand that one of the stumbling blocks for Chile joining Mercosur was the fact that some of the goods from Brazil coming to Chile were going to have a lower tariff than Chilean goods going over to Brazil, and that I heard that the Chilean people tell that the deal that Chile was signing into Mercosur was not the most appropriate for Chile. Can you elaborate on that, whether that's been the case, or how are they going to fix that problem, if indeed it is a problem?
There were problems, but I don't think that was one of them. I think one of the problems for Chile was the, as they call it in Chile, the traditional agricultural crops, wheat, corn, rice, soya, were going to be excluded, or at least at the beginning, Chile wanted them to be excluded. I think that Chile decided that they, in order to get rid of one of these dumping blocks, so they had to be included. They have now an 18-year span of time to lower the tariffs on these goods. And of course, eventually, that will be to the benefit of Argentina. Argentina, on the other side, the agricultural big guys are upset because they would have liked that 18-year to be zero or 5 years. So I think everybody gave in. On different areas, I think Brazil on the area of on what they would have liked to expand their exports into Chile, especially manufacturing goods, including cars. They again is a long term phase out, but they accepted. I think the important thing here was that all these countries. It always happens in trade negotiations that nobody's ever happy, but I think that some. Other aspects of trade negotiations, you always have to give in, and sometimes you do, sometimes you win in certain areas. I think balance-wise, it was to the benefit of the three principal countries, Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, that they it was to their benefit to reach some kind of an agreement. They're both now three democracies, and they have good relations, President Menem and President Cardoso and President Frei. They visit each other often. They very continuous dialogue and conversations with each other, and I think that's a positive sign. Is that you do have democracies for the first time in the three countries in many years, and that they respect each other. They like each other. President Cardoso was lived in Chile for many years in the 60s when he was in exile from Brazil. So his second home is Chile. President Frei and President Cardoso like each other a lot. And respect each other. And President Menem and President Frei, even though they're very different type of people, but they, because of that, they have also been able to establish a very good working relations for the first time in decades between Chile and Argentina. So I think it all bodes well for this region that you have economic integration at the same time that you have democracies trying to work their way out of problems that they have had for many years.
A number of people have said that what protected Chile post-Mexico were the capital controls that they have on investment inflows, when in fact, in my opinion, it was the favorable policies and fundamentals that they had in place that really helped them sustain the crisis. But in the aftermath of that, there seems to have been a lessening of pressure to remove those capital investment restrictions. Has there been any pressure from the U.S. side or any response from the Chilean side as you think about free capital inflows into Chile?
Would you let us know your name and affiliation?
Sure. Andrew Cummins, Global Capital.
Okay. Well, I think that Chile, for those of you that don't follow closely Chile's financial laws and investment laws, they, right now, if you invest, and that's what the gentleman was referring to, there are restrictions whereby if you invest in Chile, you have to keep your profits at least a year in Chile. And that has been in the books now for a very long time. And I think I think that if that was one out of many other considerations that helped Chile not be affected by Mexico's crisis, as so many other countries in the region were. I think also another important was not only their general economic stability, but also the savings, the tremendous savings they have of 27%, based on their privatization of their social security system. But all those things considered, I think helped Chile stop the crisis at its door. But on the issue as to whether or not this will be a subject of discussion when NAFTA comes forward, it will be, because it runs counter to some of the provisions of investments in among the four countries. Of course, the Chileans would like to keep it. That will be a subject of discussion. So I'm clear as to what will happen during the discussion. There are those that favor keeping that, because it shows, on the Mexico crisis, that Chile was able to protect itself, that this fly-by-night capital flight, which occurred in Mexico, are not necessarily good for some countries, as it proved for Mexico. So there are arguments, naturally, the other arguments that say that there should be no restrictions on investments into NAFTA countries, the very purest free traders. So I think it's going to be a touchy area of discussion. Both sides will have, I'm sure, good arguments to make on the issue. And I think it's still unclear as to what the final outcome is going to be on that subject.
As we have, as you well know, many of us here in San Francisco look to Asia as well as to the South. I think we'd be interested in knowing how does Chile perceive itself and what role will it play, does it play, in the whole Pacific Rim?
Well, as you may know, Chile was the second country that joined APEC. They just joined a year ago. This will be President Frey's third meeting that he will go to APEC in Manila at the end of November. But I think the Chileans very quickly understood, first they're a Pacific nation. They have a very long relation with the Pacific Ocean. And they have been aggressively pursuing trade with the Asian countries, especially after Chile returned to democracy in 1990. It was very difficult for Chile to start any kind of relations with almost any kind of government because of its military presence. Since 1990, they have aggressively pursued both President Aylwin and President Frey to expand their trade relations with the Asian countries. They have been very successful at it. After the U.S., Japan is the largest investor in Chile, and it's also on Asia as a blocker, the second in terms of Chile's exports. They produce things that the Asians like fish, as well as forestry goods that Chile aggressively now exploits to their benefit and to the benefit of the Asians. The trade delegations from Asian countries into Chile are just as frequent as ours, as well as the Frey delegations of Chileans into the Asian countries. President Frey did spend a long amount of time in Asia when he was the last APEC meeting in Japan, and he stayed about a week and a half traveling around different Asian countries. And I gather he, I don't know, from what I hear, he plans to also continue to travel to some other countries when he goes to the Philippines. I think Chile, so to your question, I mean, they know that they need to diversify their exports, and they have successfully done so. They have almost split it equally between their exports to the U.S., Canada, to Europe, to the Asian, and to the Latin American countries. So in that sense, that's another reason why they have been able to successfully seal themselves from the last Mexico crisis. Because they're not, their economic stronghold and their exports are not only on the hands of one group. So they're diversified, and they have been very successful in diversifying their exports. And one of those strongholds and anchors that they have, and believe it's important to have, is with the Asian countries. They have just started, only been there now, you know, less than 2 years, a member of APEC, and APEC, as we know, has not, you know, cannot really move forward until we get fast track and we can then sit down and negotiate with the Asian countries. But once that is done, that will place Chile in a privileged situation because of the aggressive practices they have on marketing, and they're very good entrepreneurs, and they're well set for exports. Different from other Latin American countries, as you know, that have never looked at exports as a means of their livelihood. So I would just think that the relations with the Asian countries will continue to grow and become stronger.
When it's in the system, I understand that Chile is particularly successful in building up its fishing industry, salmon industry, through a special type of initiative, and also its wine industry to some extent. Is there any other specific area that Chile is targeting at the moment to build up its export capability?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know, maybe the ambassador here from Chile can maybe answer that better than I. I don't know of any. I mean, I do know of salmon, and there have been, you know, salmon is not indigenous to Chile. They brought this technology into Chile in the 80s, and they're now the second largest exporters of salmon in the world after Norway. It's an amazing development that they have done in the area of salmon. And on the area of wine, they have very good wine, very good prices, as you will know. And they have now, for example, surpassed Spain as the third now largest importer of wine into the U.S., France, Italy, and now Chile. And they will take a very aggressive posture in their marketing here in the U.S. That was, for example, yesterday I went to visit the here in Napa Valley, the Mondavi Winery. And the Mondavi Corporation has just concluded the first successful U.S. investment of a U.S. winery in Chile with a very good Chilean company called the Arrasuris. It would be the $50 million investment. And I think that you will see more and more of that kind of joint ventures between, I think, Chilean and U.S. wine producers. But on the other, are there any new areas? I really don't know.
Good morning. My name is Ivan Mott from Gray International Trading. My question is, given the fact that the U.S., Canada, and Mexico have free trade,
agreements, and also Chile and Mexico have free trade agreements. Is there any data that indicates that U.S. goods are actually getting to Chile via Mexico?
Chilean goods?
No, U.S. goods going to Chile via Mexico.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know of any case, let's put it that way, unless I've been in Chile or anybody either from Mexico or Washington that have claimed that somehow one of these countries is trying to sort of go to, you know, through the back door and not be confined to their trade agreements. I haven't heard of any either complaints or cases like that.
I'm Terry Cook from Army Transnational. We've been reporting to Chile for the last 10 years. But can I just one comment or one question? The comment is that we didn't touch much on what I think is really has the best for this reform. The question has to do with the other structural reform that you talked about, which was the role of the military. I understand that 10% of the Delta's export earnings go into a fund to basically fund the military. And the question is this an unhealthy situation of independence of the military, or is it a continued guarantee of transition to democracy? And what do you think the near-term
responsibility? It's true what you say about Codelco. Codelco is the government copper mine. To put it in context, it's sort of like the Pemex of Chile. And during the military government, a provision was put of a law whereby 10% of Codelco's profits yearly goes to the armed forces. So there's no doubt that that's in addition to the regular budget that they get from Congress on personnel and administrative costs. So they do are very well funded. I would say that they're the best funded armed forces in the region. And they're very disciplined and they're very good. The relations between Chile in terms of civil military relations is still conflicted, is still difficult, it's delicate. There's some aspects of the 1980 constitution that we as U.S. government have stated in our yearly human rights reports that we don't particularly like the ones that I just mentioned to you on the designated senators and also the provisions by which the president of Chile can name generals and also into positions of commanders in chief of the armed forces, but he cannot remove them. That's, of course, a major stumbling block to have civilian control over the military, for obvious reasons. And President Frei, first President Aylwin, and then President Frei, tried to introduce amendments to the Constitution. But it's a catch-22 because of the 9 designated senators. You don't have the 2/3 majority to amend the Constitution, or it will become very difficult. If you have those 9 and you don't have other members of the opposition come forward with the government coalition, which is what happened this time around, this last time, when they spent about 8 months discussing these amendments to the Constitution without any success, and they failed to get the right number of senators. It wasn't even voted. It never even left committee to vote on the substance of the amendment. That's how acrimonious the fight was, that it was not even debated in full on the substance of the pros and cons of the amendments to the Constitution. So it's still a touchy issue. It's too close to what happened both during the agenda period and also the military government. It still carries a lot of emotion on both the left as well as on the right. But I think, at least that my view, is that time is on the side of democracy and that this is just a matter of time to happen and for these changes to occur in the Constitution. But it will take a while for this acrimonious, still sensitive issues to be, maybe it'll take maybe one more generation to be totally off the table. But I think the history was so it hit all Chileans, I think, so hard, whether you were from one side or the other, that nobody wants to go back to that or even get close to it. So I think it's just a matter of time. But I think everybody's aware of it. And I don't think there's any threat to Chile's democratic system of government.
John Meeker, attorney in private practice. I understand that in Chile they've moved from, with respect to environmental regulation, from a permissive to mandatory environmental impact reports. Do you see any effects on that on Chile's agricultural operations?
Chile is doing, I would say, since Chile's return to democracy in 1990, the government knows that if they want to compete, they want to attract investments, and also be more aggressive on their exports. They had to strengthen their environmental laws. Now they would have been under incredible scrutiny by the outside world, Europeans and us. And also that would have been an issue on the NAFTA discussions, as was an issue, as we all know, when Mexico was being discussed. So they have, in a fairly short period of time, have passed legislation to make things more stringent. And as you say, now you do have to present mandatory environmental impacts studies on a project that you make in Chile. I think that it was only 1992 when legislation was passed in the Chilean government. Before that, it was very lax. The military government environmental standards were not something that they were interested in imposing on Chile. So they still have, there's problems, and they still have problems, but at least they're working at it. I think one of the good example of that, which is the area of not so much agriculture but forestry, there was a major investment of a company out of Washington State in Tierra del Fuego called Trillium. The company's called Trillium, and it's a forestry, major forestry investment in that part of the world. It's about $250 million. Investment, and because it was such an environmentally careful area, and you were dealing with trees that were very old, they had to present very serious environmental impact studies. They did, and they were evaluated by the Chilean government. It was very controversial, but they recently allowed it to go forward. And I think that that's been a good sign both to the environmentalists on one side, because they have demanded stringent controls on the one hand, and then on the investors also, that Chile was not placing undue burdens on investors because of environmental concerns. So they were able to walk at the fine line and balance these two at times conflicted groups that not necessarily always, as we know, agree. This was a good test case, both for the Chileans as well as the outsiders, on the seriousness of the Chilean government on the one end, on environmental concerns,
and our investors that that they have to look at it also carefully when they invest in Chile. But if you look at most of the new major investments in the area of let's say, in copper, where you have U.S. and Canadian and Australian major investors in Chile. And I've visited the new copper mines, and there are at EPA or higher standards, and even higher standards than some of the copper mines that they have here in the U.S. I don't know if I answered your question on agriculture. I don't know whether you wanted to seek some specific area on the area of agriculture besides the one I mentioned.
Maybe then just one follow-up question on the issue of use of methyl bromide and the conference just convened in Europe.
Well, yeah, excuse me, I hear you talking because I don't know what that is.
Bob Sleep. Is Frey's political power as much a coalition of political parties as Allende's was, as his government was?
President Allende, in 1990, had there's a coalition government in Chile. You have the Christian Democrats, which is the largest party in the country that President Allende belongs to, as well as President Frey. Then there are two other parties. One is the Socialist Party, and there's a new party which was created during the military era called PPD, Party for Democracy. These three parties formed the coalition that existed under Allende, and they now also exist during Frey. So you do not have, from a political point of view, any change from one to the other. It's the same coalition of the three parties that have successfully been able to get together, even though they, like every party, they have their differences. But they know that they cannot exist as a government without working together with each other. So they did that successfully during the first 4 years of President Allende, and now President Frey is into his over his 2 years in office, the 6 year term president. And they have successfully also have their own coalition, not only in the executive branch, and therefore they in the ministries you have some ministers that are socialists, some ministers that are from the PPD, some ministers that are Christian Democrats. They sort of have a very careful balance on the ministers, and also at the second, third level of each ministry. But they also have a very effective coalition in Congress, especially in the House, where there is a majority to give the three of them vote. Now, they don't have that in the Senate, even though they do have, they work together in the Senate because of the nine designated senators. It's difficult for them to get things forward when the designated senators vote with the opposition, two opposition center-right party, then it's difficult to get things going on through the Senate. But maybe I gave you a long answer to your question, but the coalition is the same, and the strength of both President Allende and President Frey flows from this effective coalition of these three parties.
Bob Lenford, Jack Washington. Question back to the environment.
For those of you that don't know, there is a, well, maybe you do because he's from the world. Douglas Tompkins came to Chile, and he has now bought about 300,000 hectares of land in the southern part of Chile, and he and his wife, I should mention also her, both have decided that they want to create this national park
in Chile, and they created a foundation. And the object was that they would transfer this land to this foundation, and then they would put the money to make it into an open park for the public. Well, we would think here in the U.S. that this is just, that, I mean, nothing could be better than this. I mean, why would anybody object to what is a great good cause, which is to buy all this land, and I think he has spent about $18 million in buying this land, and is willing to give it to the Chilean public. Well, this created problems in Chile for many reasons. I think, on the one end, I don't think Latin Americans in general, or us Europeans, or maybe we're the only ones that in the world where philanthropy is understood from the private sector. So the idea that some wealthy person wants to donate and give land is immediately suspect. There must be something behind this. I think this is not just Chileans. I think it's just a mentality of any country that is not used as we are to the whole concept of philanthropy. I think also, and I have told it, so I'm not divulging any secret here. I don't think Todd Tompkins did it, I think, at the beginning the right way. I think he should have had some expert hand at public relations in Chile. You just don't go to a country, buy land, and think, and that amount of land, and think that nothing's going to happen. Okay. So I think he had some to be blamed on what then transpired afterwards. It was a lack of knowledge and ignorance and naivete and arrogance, all of those combined, that led him to some problems. Of course, it's also land that goes from the ocean to the mountains. So suddenly you have this foreigner that is coming as, you know, if his land, his national park, he bisects the country. So then that raises the military. You have this foreigner coming here, and what about, you know, if we want to move troops, you know, from one end of Chile to the other, you know, you have this national park owned by this American. So it just created a lot of problems. I think also they're believers in pro-choice, and they have actually stated that they are in books and believe that, you know, procreation should be at zero. Then you're getting another dangerous war here, because here is a very Catholic country, where the whole issue of pro-choice is not even discussed. I mean, there's abortion, but it's not allowed. In Chile, there's not even divorce. Divorce is not allowed. So if you add all of this, it became a major controversy. And what has then happened is he needed one more piece of land to unite the land that he bought. And then he became politically very sensitive, and a lot of, especially one party the most conservative party, really went after him. And it became difficult for the government, a big debate inside the government on this issue. So there were those that were pro, or those who were against, those that said, let's stay out of this, and there was no consensus in the government on this issue. The way it stands now is that this land used to belong to, it still belongs to a Catholic University of Valparaíso, and instead of selling it to Tompkins, now they're trying to raise the money for Chilean private sector to buy the remaining piece of land. And until this is resolved, Tompkins has sort of frozen his desire to pass the land he bought to his foundation. So he's just keeping it. I went to see it because I I knew this was going to be controversial, and I prefer to see things and not be told about it. And we spent 2 days with them in this very beautiful area that they have bought. I think that there's nothing, you know, nothing that they're doing that is incorrect. But it's just sensitive, and I think it's just, again, it's going to take a while before he decides whether he wants to pass this land to the foundation or not, or just keep it for him and his friends and family just to use it. And see whether there is a change of attitude of those that still question his motives. But it's controversial. Still controversial.
Hi, my name is Jessica Murray, and I'm with the Kinzer Group. And you mentioned in your speech that the Rachel Hayes came and met with his counterpart in Chile. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about the outcome of that meeting, and then specifically, to what extent does Chile have a formal transportation plan within their government, and how much the U.S. Participates within the planning process, if it's similar to the formal structure in the U.S.?
Yes, the U.S. government and Chile signed a bilateral aviation agreement 2 years ago. It's coming up now for renegotiations. So that was one of the reasons why he went to, Secretary Peña went to Chile. Are you interested in the transportation and the aviation, or just
overall? The planning process, something similar to like the ICE, the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act in the U.S., which gave the metropolitan planning organizations a little bit more federal money to plan. Infrastructure and transportation within their own areas.
I see. It's still a very centralized system. They're trying to decentralize things, but it's still very much in the hands of the Minister of Communications and Transportation. Cities have very little flexibility or autonomy to work on transportation. It's one of the big debate in Chile. There are those that believe that, especially the mayors, believe that they should have more flexibility and more freedom to decide where a road goes in that city and not have to go to Santiago and have the minister or some government official decide where that road is going to go, or if they want to change it from two ways to one way. They cannot do it. So it's still, in that sense, Chile has a way to go in terms of allowing the cities to have more autonomy, even less fiscal autonomy. So, but there is movement in that sense, I mean, inside the government that would like, and they're doing studies precisely as we speak as to how effectively they should reorganize their executive branch from, I don't know how many ministries they have, maybe 20-something, to make them less, more effective, more efficient. And also a major push by the mayors that are now elected before they were appointed. And the mayors are naturally pushing for them to have more autonomy, not just on transportation matters, but on almost any other matter. But it's in an ingrained system where you don't have centuries of centralized system of government, like so many other countries in Latin America and in Europe, and different from ours. Different history of government, and it just takes a very long time to get that central authority away from that. Others that believe that it should remain that way. I mean, there are arguments to be made on both as to whether it's good or bad to have this decentralization or centralization. And so it's a subject of debate, let's put it that way, and not yet resolved.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Vieira, for all those answering all those questions in such great detail and very comprehensively. I also want to thank our host, the World Affairs Council, our co-sponsors, the Pan American Society, as well as the Bay Area World Trade Center. There are representatives from all of these organizations here with us today. If you're interested in more information, to be on our mailing list, to be part of our organizations, we have dynamic programs from the Chilean American Chamber of Commerce. Our focus is on Chile. The other organizations are a little bit broader in focus. And you get a chance to come to more of these wonderful events and hear wonderful speakers. And I also want to thank all of you, our members of the audience, for getting up just a little bit earlier today to be able to participate in our event in such abundance. And a particular thanks to a couple members of our audience who have come from long distances, but who I consider our very wonderful loyalists that come from these long distances when we do have these events. And I hope you will now join me in giving a warm round of applause to Ambassador Guerra.